Today's Teisho will be case 23 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 23 is entitled, Think Neither Good Nor Evil. The sixth patriarch, the sixth founder, the sixth ancestor, was pursued by the monk Myo as far as Taiyu Mountain. The ancestor, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now." Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please give me your instruction." The ancestor said, "Think neither good nor evil. At this very moment, what is the original self of the monk Myo?" At these words, Myo was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and bowed, saying, "Besides the secret words and secret meanings you have just now revealed to me, is there anything else deeper still?" The ancestor said, "What I have told you is no secret at all. When you look into your own true self, whatever is deeper is found right there." Myo said, "I was with the monks under Obi for many years but could not realize my true self. But now, receiving your instructions, I know it is like a man drinking water and knowing whether it is cold or warm." "My lay brother, you are now my teacher." The ancestor said, "If you say so, but let's both call Obi our teacher. Be mindful to treasure and hold fast to what you have attained." Mumon's comment. The sixth ancestor was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. It is though he peeled a fresh lychee, removing the seed, put it into your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Mumon's verse, "You cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." I would like to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. A few weeks ago, we had quite a storm, and it disrupted our lives to a great degree. A good friend of my wife's lives in Cranford, he and his wife, Harvey and Ruth. And they're really wonderful people. And he's a retired chemistry professor. And they have a house in Cranford. And Cranford is a wonderful town, I think. I really like Cranford a lot. But it's between two rivers. And it flooded very badly. And Harvey and Ruth, their house flooded up to the... They have a basement... Water flooded up to the floorboards of their first floor. So this happened to a lot of people in New Jersey, and fortunately, this time around, our basement didn't get flooded, but we had a lot of trees go down all over Plainfield, where we live. And right after the storm, on Saturday, we went out and looked around, and there was hardly any street was unaffected. There were power lines down everywhere, and it was really quite a mess. So here we are on the other side of that event, and things are more stable. But at the time, you know, it seemed very chaotic. I was walking down the street, or I was actually jogging down the street a few days after the hurricane hit. And I was having to jog around fallen trees and fallen wires. And really beautiful old trees were torn up, and a beautiful house in my neighborhood, the tree went right through the roof, and it really smashed it up. And I know the owners of that house, they are such nice guys. Anyway, I was jogging down the street, and a guy drove up to me in his car, and he said, "Do you have power?" And I said, "No, we still don't have any power." And he said, "We don't have any power either, and you know, my basement's full of water, and I can't pump the water out because I don't have any power." And he said, "The whole country is falling apart." I thought that was a bit of an exaggeration. But it does seem that way, right? Sometimes it just seems like the whole world is falling apart. And that was just one example. If you have been following the economy, you know that things are very strange. The stock market plunged about 300 points yesterday. It's been going up and down and up and down. And unemployment figures are still very high, very high. The economy is really terrifying almost to some people. You know, if you don't have a job, this is really frightening. And that's another way in which things seem to be out of control. I have a friend of mine who just got a diagnosis of cancer. And she has to go in. She's about 60 years old. And she has to go in for tests now. And is quite worried. Feels really out of control, you know. So, you know, we have these experiences where we feel our lives are taking a course that we really don't want to follow. Really don't want to follow. Nobody wants to get cancer. You know, nobody. That's really a challenge. To have your body go haywire, in particular, is a real challenge. If you're relatively young, you know, you can have your environment around you. Your environment around you can become chaotic and uncontrollable. But we have a deep trust in our bodies. You know, we don't even think about it. It's so deep. We rely on our bodies for all kinds of stability, dependability. You know, most people go to sleep every night pretty much at the same time. They go, when they put their head down on the pillow, they go to sleep. And then the clock rings and it's time to get up, and they get up. And they might have to walk up some stairs, and they dash up the stairs, and they jump in the tub. And they can count on this, right? For the last couple of years, I was taking care of my father-in-law who died. And it was so interesting to see somebody who had trouble, real trouble with his body not working, you know, and his, you know, sometimes he just couldn't walk properly. And it wasn't dependable. You know, there are people I know who have trouble sleeping. You know, they put their head down on the pillow, but they lie there, and it's always a frightening experience in a way not to be able to sleep properly. You know, so when our bodies don't do what we want, it's especially frightening. And I think something like cancer is very frightening because we count on our bodies. They're like our best friends in a way, you know. And they're always there for us, you know. And they're always performing well. And suddenly, you know, it's like there's a problem with our best friend, with this this body which has been so dependable, and we could always rely on our feet, on our legs, and our two hands. When we reach out, we touch. You know, that's always been so. You know, so these experiences of uncontrollability can be quite unnerving. You know, and it's possible to say that you know, Zen is kind of a luxury activity. You know what I mean? You know, one way to look at Zen is to say it's about, you know, going to your cushion, sitting down, watching your breath, and getting to a nice calm place under special circumstances. You know, the lights are turned down, it's quiet, and you watch the breath, and you watch the breath, and you become very still, very quiet, very calm. Maybe you begin to feel sort of happy. And you get off the cushion and you feel okay. You know, I feel nice. I feel very calm, very centered. And it's possible to think that maybe Zen is not, you know, maybe Zen is really not meant for, you know, the real world in a certain way. You know, when things go really crazy, you know, that calmness and that the time out to sit on the cushion and watch the breath, that may seem very far away, very abstract, you know. I know that in my own family, you know, when the Great Depression happened in the 1930s, in the early 1930s, my mother's family were really wiped out, you know, really hurt. And my grandfather, through a combination of things, lost his farm and had to go to work as a hired hand on somebody else's farm. And my grandmother went to work for the governor of New York as a cook in the governor's house in New York State because she was a good cook. And my mother lived with my grandfather in a bunkhouse on this farm. And, you know, life was so challenging. My mother would talk about not having shoes in the summer. And, you know, once in a while, my grandfather would bring home an orange, and it was like a miracle, you know. I mean, an orange was so rare in those days, to be able to afford one, to even see one in the winter. And he would bring it home, and, you know, they would cut it up and eat it very carefully. And, you know, life was very challenging. And I think about that now, you know, because we have economic instability. Nobody knows what's happening. Every day, if you read the newspaper, you read about a jobless rate, people long-term unemployed. And, you know, Zen can seem very, like, as I say, sort of like a luxury item, you know. And if you can practice Zen that way, you know, you can definitely make Zen a luxury item. You know, it's important to set aside time for practice, and it's important to have a place in your apartment or your house where you can, you know, leave your cushions sitting there, and if you see your cushions every day, you're more likely to use them, you know. So you should set your cushions out somewhere and maybe have a candle and some incense. And you get up in the morning, maybe get up a little early, you sit on the cushion, you do your zazen, maybe you go to work. And all day long, maybe it's very stressful, and you can think, oh, that was such a beautiful experience, I'll try to hold on to that experience. You know? And, you know, maybe that's what Zen is about. But My feeling is that that would be sort of a misunderstanding of Zen, you know. I think that part of Zen practice is sitting on the cushion. It's sitting on the cushion and learning how to stabilize the mind and focus the mind. So that's definitely part of Zen practice. You know, people come to Zen because they have lost their trust in life, I would say. On some level, that sounds like a radical statement, you know, but even people who say, well, I'm just curious, I think on some level people come to Zen because they feel that something is missing or something about life is untrustworthy or unrewarding or something like that. And sometimes people have had real traumas that bring them to the cushion. But sometimes it's just a growing sense of dissatisfaction or somehow, you know, this issue of trust in life is part of what brings people to the cushion. And you also lose, I think trust in life is connected to this feeling that you can control events, that events are somehow working with you, not against you, and that you can take sort of like proactive steps to direct your life or give your life a kind of shape. This is a very important element of a healthy mind, is feeling that, you know, you can control your life, that that life is basically benevolent or benign, that it's working with you, and that if you know, make the effort, life is going to be okay. And I think at some point, sometimes things happen to us that undermine that sense of trust. And maybe that's what brings us to the cushion. And I think, just speaking from my own experience, you know, when I started doing Zen, I felt like somebody who had lost his footing in a stream, you know. Many years ago, I was backpacking with a friend of mine. This was like almost 30 years ago. I was in the Pecos Wilderness in New Mexico, and we were going to go into town after spending 8 days in the Pecos Wilderness, and we hadn't bathed or anything like that. And so before we went into town, I wanted to take a bath, and I went into the Pecos River near our camp area. And it was freezing cold. This was in August, but the water was still freezing cold. And very fast. And I lost my footing. And I started to go downstream. You know, it started to carry me down. And I made it. You know, I grabbed some rocks and I didn't get swept downstream. But it was really, for just a second, it was scary. And then after it was over, I realized what could have happened. You know, I could have, you know, really drowned. And that experience of like losing your grip, you know, and being swept along, I think that happens to people, you know. You know, we normally trust our legs to take us down the stairs. We, you know, go to our workplace and, you know, we expect things to work out there. We have families and we expect things to work out there. And sometimes, you know, things just deviate enough so that we feel like that guy who pulled up to me in the car and said, you know, the whole world is falling apart, you know. And so, you know, Zen is very, very important because I think it's a way of restoring your trust in life. So you sit on the, you feel like you've lost your footing and you're being carried down this crazy stream, and it's just one thing after another and frightening and maybe hurtful, you know. And so you start sitting on the cushion, you watch your breath, and all of a sudden, you know, your mind becomes stable and focused, and it's as though now you're not being swept down the stream. You're just calmly calmly floating. And it's stable, it's safe, and trustworthy, you know. And this is like a good sit. You know, you come in after a busy day, and sometimes you enter this state where you really do feel, you know, the cliches are centered, grounded, and so on. But you feel that way. You know, it's like when I was backpacking this summer up in the Sawtooth Mountains in Idaho, I wanted to take a swim in another mountain creek, and it was very turbulent, but I found this place in the stream that was like a little, where the water had carved a hole into the rock, and it was absolutely placid, and you could just, it was like a little bathtub in the river. And it was stone, you know, it was like, it must have taken, you know, maybe hundreds of years for the water to erode like that. But it was perfect, and I could just jump in, and it was freezing cold, but I was safe. Well, you know, Zazen can be like that. You know, you sit down on the cushion, and you watch your breath, and suddenly it's not like this maddening series of events, you know, just one damn thing after another. It's like you watch your breath, and you begin to feel safe. And this feeling of safety is very important. You know, on the cushion, if you practice Zen enough, you begin to have this profound feeling of safety or well-being. And this is really quite important, very healing. And the more time you spend in that state, actually, I think the better it is for you. I really think it's very, very therapeutic. And I especially think that because I believe that people often come to Zen when their sense of trust in life has eroded, I think getting to that stable, safe place is especially important, you know. Zen can be very beautiful. I myself, I love to sit. I sit a lot, you know, and I wouldn't do it if it were painful and difficult. It's really very grounding. But all the same, you know, a problem can arise in Zen practice if we think that that's it, you know, if we think that this is it, this is Zen. You know, Zen is about getting into a good space, a calm place, being centered, and then having bliss, whatever, and then it's back to work. You know, that's possibly a misunderstanding of Zen. One of the great Zen teachers, Shunryu Suzuki, the man who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, used to say that he said, for me, the problem isn't getting on the cushion. The problem is getting off the cushion. See, I think that's such an interesting thing to say. Because for most beginners, the problem is getting on the cushion. Yesterday, we were having our involvement fair on College Ave. And one of the people who volunteered to work in the involvement fair had been away for the summer. And I didn't really mean to put her on the spot, but I said, "Have you been practicing?" And she looked very guilty. And she said, "Well, not as much as I should have, you know, but now that I'm back, I'm definitely going to practice." And I have the feeling that means, no, I haven't been practicing much. You know, it's hard for beginners to get to the cushion. It's an interesting psychological problem, really, because when people sit, generally they do feel better, but they don't sit. You know, and this is why, like, practicing collectively like this can be so good, because when you make a date with other people, Every Wednesday at 7, you show up here, you'll find it easier to practice on your own. So for beginners, getting to the cushion is a challenge, even though they often feel safe, a sense of well-being, and so on, once they get to the cushion. It's this psychological conundrum you should definitely explore. You know, if you enjoy sitting and it's hard for you to sit, you should ask yourself, why is this so hard? you know, that's a good thing to think about. But at any rate, you know, for beginners, it's the challenge is getting to the cushion. But once you can enter that safe, stable, centered condition, you know, Suzuki said for him, the challenge is getting off and getting out into the world. And it's possible, as I say, to think about Zen as even somewhat escapist. There are people who would say, well, this is artificial or this is escapist because, you know, you're creating a calm environment under very special conditions. You know. What happens when those special conditions aren't there? And I actually obviously don't agree with that criticism, but there's something to it, you know. The more advanced you are in Zen practice, the more you should be able to maintain that stable, centered, trusting mind off the cushion, off the cushion. And this is a real, this is really a challenge. This can really be a challenge. Because, you know, you will find, perhaps, that when you're in a difficult situation, you aren't with it, you know? You aren't with it. You know, there's this, you might suddenly realize that, you know, you're unhappy to be there, right? We all do this sometimes. This happens to all of us. But, you know, I think that because we have this faculty of imagination, it's possible for us to distance ourselves from what's happening. And in a way, even Zen is about distancing ourselves from what's happening. But if you notice carefully, if you observe yourself carefully, I think you'll notice something quite interesting, which is that when this sense of distrust arises, or this sense of doubt about what's happening arises, suffering also arises. You know, don't always notice this because our awareness is too crude. But if you try to observe your habitual responses, I think you'll notice that sometimes when you're in pain or you're feeling out of control, there's a very powerful desire to withdraw or not be present with what's happening. This is very human and very common. I can remember when I was a little kid, for some reason, I was very self-conscious as a little kid. I wanted to be liked by all the other little kids. And my mother wanted to buy me a lunchbox. In these days, I don't know how it is now, but back then, kids often brought their lunch to school. And the mothers would make a sandwich, and this was before Saran wrap. So the sandwiches were in wax paper, and so you would have like a sandwich, and you would have like maybe your mom would give you an apple or apple slices, and you could put it in a metal box that would have hold your lunch, and it usually held a thermos of milk or some other beverage, you know. But this was before all the kids drank Coke, so it would be something organic, you know. So I wanted, at that time, there was a television show on called Zorro. It was a wonderful Disney program, and it was about a mysterious masked liberator who fought in Mexico for the people against the tyrannical government. And he was a mysterious, dashing, the song said he was a bold renegade who carves a Z with his blade, and he would put a Z in somebody's clothes or in the wood or something, and then he'd dash away on his horse. So I thought he was incredibly cool. I wanted to be like Zorro. And my mother bought me a Zorro lunchbox. And I thought somehow that this would be very well received by my friends. And I remember getting my lunchbox at lunchtime and carrying it across the room, and my thermos leaked. And I left a trail of milk all across the floor. And so I'm walking from where we kept our lunch boxes and hung our coats. I'm walking to the table. And they used to put oil cloth on the tables at lunchtime. They were like bright colors, blue, orange, yellow. It was beautiful. So the orange, the cloths were, oil cloth was spread on the tables. We were going to have our lunch. And I'm carrying my lunch box. And it's making this trail of milk along the floor, but I don't know it. And I'm walking along, and suddenly everybody starts laughing at me. And the whole class is laughing at me. For a certain kind of kid, this would be wonderful, right? For a certain kind of kid, this would be great. It would be like the star of the show. But for another kind of kid, this would be mortifying. And I was the kind of kid, this was like, oh my God, they're all laughing at me, you know. I was hoping that I would be liked because I had a Zorro lunchbox, you know. So this was so mortifying. I can remember when I was embarrassed like that, the world would just disappear. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but you're so embarrassed, you just withdraw into yourself and everything disappears. I can remember, it's just like their voices trail off and I'm just totally inside myself. I don't know if you've had that experience, but I think when we're in an unpleasant situation, we have this very powerful drive to separate ourselves from what's happening. And, you know, we might actually, you know, enter into a daydream state where we're thinking of a more pleasant time, or, you know, we're having a sexual fantasy, or, you know, basically... you know, you begin to crave like a drink, or you start, you know, maybe you reach for some music to listen to, anything to get out of the moment, you know, out of the moment. We have this powerful drive to be separate from what's happening to us when it's not controllable or pleasant. And we don't normally notice this opening or this separation opening up, you know. But if you observe yourself, you'll notice sometime that it really does open up. It's like when you're unhappy, you know, you can sink into a kind of dream state or reverie, it can take other forms too, you know. When I was in graduate school, I remember when I had to take my doctoral exams. You have to read for about a year for your exams, and in English it's ridiculous. You have to read everything that's ever been written in the English language, almost, you know. And you can't. I would read so much I couldn't even remember what I read. You know, did I read that? I can't remember. You know, and I couldn't remember what it was about and things like that. I know I looked at the words on the page. And during this period, I was under a lot of pressure. I would just get up every day and read. And I remember at that time, politics, the political situation, really bothered me. I was like, I would get up every day and I would just be furious. At that time, it was Reagan. It would just be like, Reagan. And I would just think about him like obsessively all day. And I also think this was a way of not dealing with my situation, you know, just getting out of my own skin, you know, getting out of my own life and entering some other place, you know, even the arts come from this impulse, you know. There's a wonderful book called written by a man, he used to be at Rutgers, his name was Richard Poirier. And it's about art, and it's called A World Elsewhere. See? And this is such a powerful human drive, right? Not to be here. Not to be here, but to be in the world elsewhere. You know, even like heaven is the world elsewhere. It's like this idea, let me out of here, some other place. Some other place, please. And it's possible to think that Zen itself is taking us to a world elsewhere, right? We sit down on the cushion, we enter this samadhi state, everything seems connected. But I don't really accept that. I think you have to be able to enter that state in order to go on to the next stage. And the next stage is like dynamic practice, right? And that means that we try to maintain that undivided mind in the world, as we're going through our day, you know. And this takes a great deal of practice because, as I say, we have this powerful drive to separate ourselves when we feel uncontrolled or when we feel in a painful circumstance or a difficult circumstance. But what I would like to suggest is that the more often we do that, the more likely it is that we are going to be suffering, strangely. You know, I think we, on some instinctive level, believe that if we withdraw from painful circumstances, the pain will go away and we'll be happy. But I think it creates a kind of mindset which is very unhealthy. That habit of withdrawing creates an unhealthy mind. And I think you begin to separate yourself from the world in a way that is almost like a guaranteed to produce a depression and other kinds of like dysfunctional habits, you know. I would just say please observe you know, my feeling is that when we're in a difficult situation and we feel this desire to withdraw, withdrawing creates a split in our world, and that split, it becomes a feature of our life, that sense of separation, and that ultimately that sense of separation is like the source of suffering. It produces suffering, and I think that depression, which is such a big problem, is closely related to that mindset, that sort of mindset of not owning the moment, you know. Among other things, I think it creates a tremendous sense of powerlessness and being out of I think it increases the sense of being out of control or incapable of acting, you know. And so you know, people who have been practicing for a while, I think, become aware of this problem, and there's a way of embracing the moment, you know, not allowing yourself to withdraw in this way, but to try to become one with things as they are unfolding, and you know, this is as simple as just focusing on what you're doing, you know, just being. Trying to be fully present. You know, when we're on the cushion, we're really not withdrawing from the world. We're focusing on the breath. It's very simple. You know, it might feel sometimes like we're withdrawing, but we're not. We're focusing the mind on one simple thing, which is breath. And the mind wants to withdraw from the breath. You know, but we keep bringing the mind back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath, and we're making a habit out of not withdrawing. You know, we're focusing on the breath, on this moment, on this moment, on this moment, under very controlled circumstances, right? It is quiet. You know, you're on a nice, comfortable cushion. You're in maybe a Zazen posture, which allows the mind to be very stable and energized. Okay, but off the cushion too, this kind of one-pointed mind is very important, you know. And you can have that kind of focus as you're going through your day. you know, as you're going through your day, you want to focus, be one with, you know, be one with. Now, it's very difficult to be one with things that are frightening or unpleasant. You know, so, you know, if you go to the doctor and the doctor says, you have cancer, you know, that's a world people don't want to be in. There's nobody here who would say, oh, I would like to be in that world. And it would be, it would seem almost insane in a way to say, I embrace my cancer. But actually, that would be Zen practice. I embrace whatever is happening 100%. See, I embrace whatever is happening 100%. And I must admit, I haven't had cancer yet, right? But probably sooner or later. When I have had situations, when I do have situations that are challenging and difficult, I don't always handle them well, because I'm a human being. But when I handle them well, I'm 100% in the moment with whatever is happening. You know, it's like I accept this without qualification. This is not passivity, right? This is not passivity. But you can't be in any other moment than this moment, you know? So if you go home and, you know, basically, you go home and it turns out your basement is full of water, you know, you really can't, you can deal with that in a number of ways. You could say, oh, I wish this weren't so. You could let that space open up. You could say, oh, if only, you know, everybody else in the neighborhood has a dry basement but me. Why me? You know, why is this happening to me? This is like the space opening up, right? Maybe you're going out with somebody and basically the relationship doesn't work out. And you could come home and say, oh my God, everybody I know has a happy relationship except me, on the whole earth. Right? Why me? Why did this happen? If only I'd done this differently. If I just called right now, I'd be in paradise. And if I just called her last Saturday, or just called him last Saturday, right now we'd be strolling hand in hand. It would be sunny instead of cloudy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. See, this is the space opening up. When we begin to do this, and we do it mentally all the time, it's like, beware. Because what you have to kind of say is, I embrace what's happening 100%. Right? It's like, this. There's no other life that could be mine right now other than this moment. You know, I choose to be here. I choose it. I accept it. You know, this is like, there's a kind of a samadhi that takes place on the cushion, right? You become one with your breath. You become one with emptiness, right? And this has the effect of stabilizing the mind, removing your obstacles, helping you work through your unexamined fears and attachments. And then, you know, the other side of practice is this dynamic active practice where you're constantly accepting or embracing moment by moment reality, right? Without any, you know, ideally, without any reservations. Just, you know, it's just like Zazen. When we're sitting on the cushion, you know, you can't make a deal. You can't say, well, you can't control it. You can't say, I'm going to sit down today and have a fantastic sit. It's going to be wonderful. That's a surefire formula for unhappiness, right? You come in, you sit down on the cushion, and your legs hurt from the word go. You have indigestion. Your head hurts because maybe you have a cold coming on. You can't focus, etc., etc. One day you come in, you sit down on the cushion, you don't expect anything, you think, I just want to get done the sit and get out of here, I have a lot of work to do. and you have this bam, wonderful experience. You know? So, basically, Zen teaches you that you can't control things. You can't control things. You can do your best, but then things are going to unfold. And when we recognize that we can't control things, we have this impulse to withdraw. But it would be better to say, I am this. See, I mean, to say I embrace this is good, but to say, I am this moment. This is my adventure. This is my adventure. This is my life. There's not any other life available to me but what's happening right now. And the difference is if you say, I reject it, that's suffering. And if you say, I accept it, that's actually very, very, very energizing and enabling. See? So, this is like advanced practice, right? You know, practice off the cushion is also like mental cultivation. You know, you can see in yourself, if you observe your mind, how this space opens up. The I don't want to be here mentality takes many forms. Daydreaming, fantasy, self-loathing, basically, people, all of these are forms of withdrawal from the moment. Self-loathing is also like a response to the uncontrollability of things. Self-loathing is really complicated because it comes from, I would say, having an imaginary life, where things are different from the real world, and then blaming yourself because the imaginary life isn't real. See? So basically, you have to give a talk. You give the talk, and you're imagining that at the end of the talk, everybody's going to clap and go, "Brilliant! That was fantastic!" You know, "Send me your paper." You know, "That's so wonderful! You're a genius!" You know. And so that's the fantasy, right? And you give the talk, and then at the end, there's some polite applause, and people get up and they walk out, and nobody seems very interested. And you go, "Oh, what an asshole I am! I would love to be that other person, you know, the one who gave the really good talk, you know, and have instead I'm this schmuck, you know." Okay, this is so common, right? This is another kind of distancing, right? It's another kind of distancing. The only talk you could possibly have given in the entire universe is the talk you gave, right? And you have like a moment where you can say, "I reject" or "I accept," you know? It's not really one moment, but there's always this impulse to reject and to say, "No, this is not my reality. I don't accept it. I'm a better person than this," right? And that's a big mistake. You know, I think that creates enormous... When you withdraw in that way, suffering follows absolutely. It's just like night follows day. The minute you withdraw from the moment, that suffering arises instantly. Check it out. Observe. You know, the practice off the cushion is constantly saying, "This, I am this. I am this. I am this." If you erase that distance, if you can erase that distance, you will feel better. You will feel better. I don't know, I'm an English teacher, so please forgive me. But Hamlet is a great play because it's about a guy who's totally caught up in fantasy, right? His father is murdered, right? And he can't deal with it. And he's lost in his fantasy and his introspection through the whole play. And he can't free himself from not, he doesn't want to be in the world. He wants to be in some, he wants to be in a world elsewhere. And at the very end of the play, he gets his act together and he said, you know what? I can't recite the lines from Shakespeare, but he basically says, you know, there's a kind of order to things that's unfolding automatically, and I just have to trust it. You know, he says there's a divinity that shapes our ends, basically. So he thinks, I can trust this process even though I can't control it, and I'm just going to go with it. Of course, then he's killed. But it doesn't matter, see? It doesn't matter because he's free. He's free. He's in the flow. See, this is so important. He doesn't go down miserable. He goes down lighthearted, and he has this sense of freedom finally. Like he's solved his problem. See, and I think that's very liberating. I think that's real freedom. So what does this have to do with the koan? Think neither good nor evil. Wei Nang was an illiterate woodcutter who went to a temple and trained, and he was sent into the kitchen to work pounding rice. And when the head of the temple, who's called Obai here, was getting very old, he wanted to pass on authority for teaching at the temple to one of the monks, the monk who had the deepest insight. And it turned out that Wei Nang, this illiterate woodcutter, had the deepest insight of anybody in the temple, even though he wasn't a monk, and even though he hadn't been doing much zazen, actually. He had just been working in the kitchen, husking rice, pounding rice with a hammer. And basically, Obai asked Wei Nang to come to see him. And he said, you know, you have the deepest understanding of enlightened mind. You don't allow any separation between yourself and what's happening. You don't allow that separation to arise. You're 100% with events as they unfold. You keep saying, this is I. This is I, this is me, this is me, this is my true self, this is myself, this is myself. And because of this, you are deeply awake, okay? So he said, I'm going to give you the robe and the bowl, the begging bowl and the robe that were given to me by my teacher and that come from Bodhidharma. But if I announce to all these monks that you're my Dharma heir, they're going to kill you out of jealousy. They're not enlightened. They're going to be totally jealous. So you've got to get out of here. You've got to flee right now. This is a story, of course. Okay. So anyway, Wei Nang flees. And he runs away from the monastery with the robe and the bowl. At some point, the character in here, Monk Myo, hears that the robe and the bowl are gone from the temple. And they can't believe that Obai has given it to this guy. They say he must have stolen it. You know, Obai is old, he's feeble, he's out of his mind. This con artist got the robe and the bowl and took them. You know, so Myo says, I'm going to find the robe and bowl and bring them back to the temple. And Myo is a retired military officer, actually. So he goes after Wei Nang, and he's a good tracker, you know, and he tracks Wei Nang down. And Wei Nang is basically like taking a bath in the river. And the robe and the bowl are on the rock next to him. And basically, Myo comes out of the hills, and he reaches down to grab the robe and the bowl, but he can't lift them. It's like he has a nervous breakdown, basically. He can't move, pick these things up off the ground. And so he has like a crisis. He said, Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and it would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he says, you know, help me, you know, what's happening to me? And the patriarch, the ancestor, Wei Neng, says, think neither, the path to liberation is to think neither good nor evil. Just be 100% with what is happening. You know, Mule created an obstacle for himself. It became impossible for him to be in the world because reality wasn't the way he wanted it to be. Right? Reality wasn't the way he wanted it to be. And the more unhappy he became with the way things are as they unfold, inevitably, the more paralyzed he, that sense of separation is paralyzing. Yeah. And finally, he just was totally paralyzed. And then he says, how do I get out of this paralysis? And Wei Neng says, look, it's so easy. Just be 100% with what's happening. Just, you've been practicing. He could say to him, look, you've been becoming one with your breath for 15 years. You've been becoming one with emptiness for 15 years. You know how to become one. You do it all the time on the cushion. Become one with whatever is happening right now. And Myo does that. And he has an enlightenment experience. He says. And he does. And he has an enlightenment experience. And he says, what other secrets have you got? That was great, you know. And Wei Neng basically says, that's it. That's all there is. And he says, let's go back and see our old teacher and tell him how happy we are to be living in this world. And that's how the koan ends. So, we have hurricanes in life. We have double-dip recessions. I'll wrap it up. But let me just say, Sandy gave me a book, which I'm going to put on the book list. It's a history of Zen by a guy named Peter Hershock. And I highly recommend it. It's really a wonderful book. And he points something out, that Zen comes from a time in China. Zen emerges at a time in China of incredible suffering. Unbelievable. More than half of all the people in China died because of these wars and famine. That's unheard of, right? It's like half the country died. We haven't seen death like that since Genghis Khan, basically. Half the people in China died. And everybody was paralyzed and demoralized and unable to act. And Zen arose out of this crisis. And Zen is not about just sitting on the cushion calming the mind. That's crucial. But Zen ultimately is about becoming one with events as they unfold. So, if you go to the doctor and the doctor says, sit down, you sit down. And you say, I am this, you know? And it doesn't mean you say, I have cancer, I'll die. It's like, my adventure now is to deal with cancer. My adventure now is to deal with bankruptcy. My adventure now is to deal, and you embrace it. You know, this is myself. And I'm going to be creative, constructive, energetic, and I'm going to accept 100% what is happening in this moment. See, this is active Zen. This is Zen off the cushion. The sixth patriarch was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. It is as if he peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. That's the moment. Mumon's verse, you cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it, don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to hide. This world is the only world that is. This moment is the only world that is. So it's hiding that creates the suffering. Okay? Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it won't be destroyed.